listening to CinemaJaw, the greatest movies podcast ever, recorded on location at the Original Mothers in Chicago. My name is Matt Kay, and with me is...
Rye the Movie Guy, and this week on CinemaJaw, we have a Jaw retrospective as we take a look back at the year 1988.
And it was a fantastic year for film, in my opinion, Rye.
It sure was, and it's always a surprise to look back at these years, too, because... you forget what movies come out and look at them in a big group like that. And we came to 1988. How? How did we pick this year, Matt?
I pulled a coin out of actually, it wasn't even my pocket. It was my friend's pocket. I didn't have any coins, Rye. That's just how it rolled.
And the coin said 1988, so yep. We looked back, did our research, and we picked our five favorite films from 1988. We got tons of facts about that year.
Yep. And I got to tell you, honestly... oh, before we get too deep into this, we should say, you might have noticed the difference at the beginning of the show.
Absolutely. There's a brand new intro song, Matt. Tell us about it.
We needed a new song because we've gotten some, although I think it's a clear example of the fair use law because we're a movies journalism show, arguably. Fair use says you can use clips from movies and stuff like that, but okay, maybe our intro music was, maybe could be construed as copyright infringement. Before, so we needed something original.
Right.
So I reached out to my buddy Joe Pissweasel Russo.
Who?
Joe Pissweasel Russo. He's a great guy, Pissweasel, and I used to be in a band with him back in the day. And I said, hey, you got a song, maybe something laying around that we could use? And he gave us this, and dude, I love it.
So do I. Awesome riff to get us started here on CinemaJaw.
Yeah, it gets me pumped. I'm ready.
I love it. So besides a new intro song and besides looking back at the year of 1988, we also have DVD reviews for you. Our feature review, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. Me and Matt both checked it out. That's the third one in the Millennium Trilogy. I caught Buried with Ryan Reynolds and Secretariat with Diane Lane. And Matt saw...
I saw The Corporation... a couple of docs. I saw The Corporation and I saw Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work.
Wonderful. So we got all those reviews for you. Eye for an Eye, Hollywood Headlines, and a whole lot more.
It's a full show, man.
All right, let's get started, Matt. Eye for an Eye, Interested or Ignore, on a couple of new movies opening up. The first one is called I Am Number 4. Extraordinary teen John Smith is a fugitive on the run from the ruthless enemy sent to destroy him. Three like him have already been killed. He is number 4. Changing his identity, moving from town to town with his guardian Henry, John is always the new kid with no ties to his past. In the small Ohio town he now calls home, John encounters an unexpected, life-changing event, his first love. The film is directed by DJ Caruso, who recently directed Disturbia and Eagle Eye, both Shia LaBeouf films.
Yeah, not bad.
Matt, interested or ignore on I Am Number 4?
Mildly interested, actually. It's mild, but it's interested.
Sure. It's based on a novel of the same name. It's brought to us by Disney. I'm not going to full-on say ignore. I am no way going to see this in the theater, but I may give it a rent. I'm going to join you on the interested.
I like it.
Interesting premise, and they don't give too much away in the trailer, and not having read the book, I'm excited to see where this movie goes.
The kid's got powers, right? I mean, this is...
he does.
It's, I always like when they take the superhero thing and they make, you know, twist it. Shed a new light on it, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, instead of being the normal superhero story that we
capes
constantly
and tights.
See.
Yeah,
sure. So two interesteds for I Am Number 4. The other new movie opening up is Unknown. A man awakens from a coma, only to discover that someone has taken his identity and that no one, not even his wife, believes him. With the help of a young woman, he sets out to prove who he is. The film stars Liam Neeson and a lot of cheap action. Matt, interested or ignore on Unknown?
Oh, man. Poor Liam. Ignore.
They should have just named this one Taken 2 because someone has taken his identity.
It's Unknown!
I'm giving this one an ignore as well. I agree with you when you say poor Liam. What's going on with this guy? There was at one time, this guy was a respectable actor. It seems like he's starting to become the B-roll king.
Oscar Schindler himself. I mean, need I say more? You know, also Qui-Gon from Star Wars. This guy's got great roles under his belt. And this is not one of them, it looks like.
No, I don't know what's going on with this guy picking his roles, but Unknown looks...
it could be worse. I mean, he could be the Rock, you know?
Yeah, true, true. So there you go. I Am Number 4 gets two interesteds from me and Matt. Unknown gets two ignores. We're agreeing right now. We'll see how we do when we get to our lists for favorite films in 1988, though. Before we get to that list, though, our feature review, The girl who kicked the hornet's nest.
Yeah.
Lisbeth and Mikkel are back for the third and final installment of the Millennium Trilogy. The story picks up right after the second one, with Lisbeth in the hospital recovering from the altercation with her father and stepbrother. Meanwhile, Mikkel has all the facts of a hidden organization within the government and plans to publish the story to blow the conspiracy that has been going on. The movie is once again cut between two storylines. I found Lisbeth's story in this one a little boring. Recovering at the hospital and then later in court trying to clear her name while supporting evidence that she was sexually abused and more. Meanwhile, Mikkel is running around, dotting the I's and crossing the T's in his story, which we have most of the facts from already. We got those in the second film. Overall, this movie was flat, and I would not have liked it at all if it did not include the story of two characters who I really do care for. Rye the Movie Guy is great on this one. Only two Jaws, a great of a C. Matt, I was disappointed.
I would agree with that review. I don't want to say disappointment. I think that's a little strong, but I was not... It certainly didn't do what the first movie did for me. This was not a hit. It was an adequate ending, is what I believe I wrote on Twitter. And I think I gave it 3 Jaws. So I'm right there with you.
Yeah, it seems like they went down in order. One was the best. Second one was good. Obviously not as good
as
the first.
But...
And then the third was just worse than that.
Yeah, agreed. I don't know. Were there different directors or something? I have to look this up.
Because... Yeah, there were two directors on second and third was the same director. The first one was...
Obviously, a different,
yeah, director. And that film was amazing. But I think the story lends itself to be a better film as well, as they were trying to solve this mystery that was going on. Really, you were seeing just a little bit of Lisbeth's backstory, where in the second and third ones, that was really the whole story, was her backstory.
Yeah, I love that character too, man. And Blomquist. He's great.
I mean, really, this movie, I think, would just be terrible if we didn't care for those two characters, because really not enough happens in the movie. To conclude, maybe it worked on when you're reading it as a book, it works on
Have you read all the novels?
I have not.
Have you read any
None.
Of them? I just started reading The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and it's vastly different from the movie.
Really?
Yeah, and a lot of people say they put it down after, you know, the first couple chapters are slow. Maybe because I saw the movie, I am tearing right through it, man. I love it. It's a great book.
Yeah, that's all I've heard, and obviously that's why they're remaking these now into the U.S. versions. The first one is due out the end of this year.
Oh, did you see the, I believe it was GQ magazine spread with the new Lisbeth?
No, I haven't seen it. I have seen her on the internet, who it is, but I haven't seen her in this GQ.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up and show you on the iPad. She's all blonde and wavy, very, she was blonde. She dyes her hair for the film. Very different look from the Swedish actress that they chose. So we'll see how that pans out.
And I love these original films. It's going to be tough for me to really watch the U.S. versions, because I think they did such a great job capturing these characters on screen. It's going to be tough to manage to do the U.S. version and be as sort of aggressive on screen, because these were a dark story to tell.
Agreed. Although I think U.S. films sometimes get more aggressive. And if they, like I said, the story in the book is so vastly different. I think if the U.S. film follows some more of the threads from the book, it might be okay. I was in your camp before I started reading this book, and I'm thinking if they stick closer to the book, we got a whole different story here. I mean, the Swedish film is an interpretation of the book, but it's not all that true to it. So
interesting.
Yeah.
So you're saying there's room to explore. With a different interpretation of the book.
I'm saying that with a grain of salt because, you know, in all likelihood, what they'll do is just remake the Swedish film shot for shot with American actors. And it's going to suck.
How predictable, yeah. Daniel Craig.
Yeah. Although I think he's a way better choice for Blomquist.
Yeah, well, we'll see, because I ended up liking this Blomquist a lot. And I who knew this actor? Obviously, Swedish actor who I did not know at all, and now I love this guy.
I do, too. I absolutely do. But, you know, the thing from the books is Blomquist is supposed to be this ladies' man who's, like, tremendously good-looking. And this guy, we keep calling him this guy. I should know his name. But in any event, he's not the best-looking actor.
No, I agree. He's definitely not a ladies' man in the films, in the Swedish versions.
Daniel Craig. Probably a little better looking. I'm sorry.
But
that's my take.
So there you have it. I overall highly recommend checking out this trilogy. It's fantastic. Even though the third one, I think, is a little painful to watch. I'm still giving it 2 Jaws. Sounds like Matt's giving it 3.
Yeah, I'll give it 3. Only because you need the story to end. So
yeah. All right. So this one came out just this past year, did not come out in 1988. But doing a Jaw retrospective, looking back at 1988, like you said as we came in here before we went on air, what an awesome year of movies.
Oh, man. I had a really tough time. I know we say that a lot, but narrowing this down was painful. Painful.
But we have to do that.
I know we do. It's our job, Rye.
Absolutely. And before we get to our five favorite picks for 1988 films, I have some interesting facts for you, Matt. From the year 1988, get this, the Hubble telescope goes into operation.
Oh.
All right. Prozac is sold for the first time as an antidepressant.
Wow.
Yo, MTV Raps debuts on TV.
Oh, Dr. Dre and Ed Lover. What?
CDs. For the first time, outsell albums.
Hmm. Landmark right there.
Also in 1988, Sonny Bono becomes mayor of Palm Springs.
Yeah. Wow. Sonny.
U2 records Rattle and Hum.
Good album.
And George Bush Sr. is elected president.
It's the beginning of the end, really. 1988, huh? That's
good
pretty
old
much
1988.
What we're saying. This is the last good year, folks.
I wonder what the highest grossing films were, Matt.
Well, actually, I have those numbers.
You do?
I do, yeah. Should I go from the top or the bottom, up or down? What do you say?
Start from the bottom and go up.
All right. At 10, we got Beetlejuice. It raked in $73 million. Cocktail was at number 8 with $78.2 million. Naked Gun was $78.7 million. Halloween 4, Return of Michael Myers, $83 million. It jumps from here. Crocodile Dundee 2 with $109 million. Twins. $111 million. Nightmare on Elm Street was $114 million. Coming to America was number 3 with $128 million. Who Framed Roger Rabbit was at number 2 with $156 million. And Rain Man tops off the list, $172 million at the box office gross.
Wow.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And also should be noted, what we like to do is compare a lot of our picks to the Academy Awards that year as far as nominated films.
Sure.
So I'm going to list those nominated for Best Picture that year. The five films that were nominated were The Accidental Tourist, Dangerous Liaisons, Mississippi Burning, Rain Man, and Working Girl.
Two of those movies are good. None of them are on my list.
Wow. None of them are on
your
list?
Not a single one.
You don't agree with any of those?
I'm not saying I don't agree. I'm just saying they're not on my list.
Now, last time we did this, we've only done one other Jaw retrospective, and at that time I had none of them on my list as well. This time I actually agree with that and have two of those on my list.
I can pretty much, I think I know which two.
All right.
One for sure I know.
All right, exciting. Since you're Mr. Know-It-All, why don't you get us started off with your number 5 on the list?
All right, but I have to preface this. Like I said, this was such a difficult year. I actually have 16 rapid fire. Here we go.
Oh, wow.
16 through 6. Ready? 16, License to Drive. 15, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. 14, The Great Outdoors. 13, Funny Farm. 12, Bright Lights, Big City. 11, Big. 10, Young Guns. 9, Willow. 8, Midnight Run. 7, A Fish Called Wanda. And 6 is Die Hard.
Nice.
So none of those films are going to be on my top 5.
Interesting. Yes. Interesting. That was rapid fire with Matt Kay.
Rapid fire. Couldn't even keep up with the bell.
Can't wait to hear what number 5 is.
Dirty, Rotten Scoundrels.
I am very, very, very unfamiliar with this movie.
Really?
I don't think I've seen it all the way through ever.
Oh.
True story, Matt. True story.
Oh, man. You are a heathen. This movie is fantastic. It's Steve Martin and Michael Caine. Probably at the pinnacle, all right? These two together just ooze coolness and comedy timing. Their presence together on the screen is just a treat. And Gene Headley comes in to round out the cast as the female interest in the movie. So basically, the premise is these two guys are con artists. One of them, Steve Martin's character, is an American, and he's sort of crass. And he finds himself out in the French Riviera, and he runs into this guy who's got it down to a science. They take rich women. You know?
Sure.
Michael Caine's character is very suave. So he agrees after some coercing to teach Steve Martin's character the tricks of the trade and yada yada. And it becomes a big swindle and scam in and of itself. It's a great con man movie. And it's freaking hilarious.
That's awesome. Don't we have a clip from that?
I do. You're making me so happy now that I get to play a clip. Hang on.
This is a clip from Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Driving relaxes you, Prince.
happiest day of my life. I think my testicles are dropping.
I love this movie, man. I could watch it again and again. I think I had this on VHS, you know, in my house growing up when I was a kid. And this was one, like an old standby I could throw on and have a few laughs. I really like it.
Well, that's interesting that you say that because picking a year like 1988, obviously, we were much younger back then. And these are the kind of movies that I think sort of stick with you that I've watched numerous times at this point. They have sort of a very fond memory when I look back at them, and that's sort of why they landed on my list. And my number five pick was one that you mentioned in your rapid fire, Matt, and that was Willow.
Oh, I love that movie, dude. It's a fantastic pick. Good pick.
It is directed by Ron Howard, written by George Lucas. It stars Val Kilmer. What could be wrong with this movie? In some ways, now you can almost look at it as like a miniature Lord of the Rings. In some ways, you know, it was like
no pun intended there, huh?
Yeah, with this mass adventure going on. Of course, they find the little baby. Willow finds the baby and is trying to return the baby. And Val Kilmer's the knight that they find in the cage. And you got the little pixies.
Mad Mardigan, yeah.
Yeah, Mad Mardigan. And it's such an adventure. We mentioned this movie and we talked about it when we did the Swords and Sorcery.
Yeah, we did. That's right.
And it's just a fun movie for the whole family type of film. It's a family film all the way through. You can sit there and watch it numerous times. Adventure piece. Again, George Lucas wrote the story with Ron Howard directing it. Did a great job. Very, very fond memories of watching Willow. Had to put it on my list. Number five.
Oh, I love that movie. I again, this is one I think I had on VHS and wore out the tape, man. I love it. And it's probably my favorite Val Kilmer movie of all time.
Really?
Although maybe Real Genius. It's a toss-up between those two.
Yeah, he's phenomenal in this one, though.
He really is.
He fits this character absolutely perfect.
Mad Mardigan.
Yeah, and after he did that, I thought, wow, here he's going to become this leading man, action hero kind of guy. And then he did independent movies from there on out and you know, like a supporting role in Heat, but pretty much no leading roles in action films.
Anyway. Nothing big like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was my number five, Willow. What do we got, Matt, at your number four?
I believe I've talked about this film before, too. John Carpenter, the John Carpenter joint, They Live. And I got a clip from this one, too, dude. This is probably one of my favorite movie clips of all time, or quotes, I should say, so I'm going to just play it.
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit. He's all out of bubblegum.
Seriously, John Carpenter, kudos to you, sir, for writing that line. Because I think Duke Nukem stole it. It's been used so many times over and over again. It's great.
You're on a roll here, Matt. Here is another film. I have never seen this one. I don't know. I'm not even familiar with this. I think I've seen clips of it, but have never sat down and watched They Live.
You know who's in They Live?
Rowdy Piper.
Yes, Rowdy Piper, but that's not even who I was going to bring up. Keith David, who plays sort of his action hero buddy in this film. And you might remember him as the drug dealer that Jennifer Connelly's character gets messed up with in Requiem for a Dream.
Sure.
And he was in Platoon, he was in Crash. Mr. and Mrs. Smith, he's been in a lot of stuff, and I just love him in this. Probably one of the best fight scenes ever committed to film is in this movie between Rowdy Piper and Keith David. Right on the cement, they're doing wrestling moves like a pile driver onto concrete. It's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right, so that was Matt's number four, They Live. Before we get to my number four, throwback in the Academy Award nominees, I wanted to mention for Best Actor in a Leading Role in 1988, the nominees were Gene Hackman, Mississippi Burning, Tom Hanks for Big, Dustin Hoffman for Rain Man, Edward James Olmos, Stand and Deliver, and Max von Sydow for Pella the Conqueror.
Mm.
Unfamiliar with him.
Me too.
But the reason I wanted to bring it up was Gene Hackman was nominated for Mississippi Burning, and that's where that comes in on my list. Number four film favorite of 1988, Mississippi Burning.
Never seen it.
Ah, I finally stumped Matt after he threw two at me that I didn't see.
Yeah.
You know what? It's been a long time since I've seen this one, but such fond memories watching this one. I watched it by myself and just was totally drawn into this story. It's obviously a civil rights type story.
I was gonna say.
FBI agents investigating the murder of a civil rights worker during the 1960s. The conspiracy of silence in a small southern town where the segregation divides black and white. Gene Hackman's in it. Frances McDormand,
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's a spectacular film. But it's been years since I've really sat down and watched this thing. Probably a good 12 years since I've seen it myself. So as soon as I was doing the research for this, it's like, wow. Put it on my queue right away.
I
love doing that. I'm like, I haven't seen this movie in so long, and I absolutely love it. And it's already starting to fade. Like, I got to check this movie out again because I love Gene Hackman. And this is one of his best performances, in my opinion. Mississippi Burning, you got to put this one on your queue.
I will, dude. You know, that's the best thing about doing these retrospective episodes. I want to put all these movies back on my queue again and watch them again.
And before I forget, you know who else is in it? Is Willem Dafoe is also in Mississippi Burning. So it's Willem Dafoe, Gene Hackman, Frances McDormand. Ah, what a film. My number four pick, favorite of 1988.
I like it. All right, so I guess my number three is next, huh?
Oh, boy.
Yeah, here we go. So speaking of the number three, if you say this guy's name three times, he will appear. Beetlejuice. I don't even know where to begin. Gina Davis, of course, Michael Keaton, a young Michael Keaton, and Alec Baldwin rounds out the cast. A skinny Alec Baldwin. This movie came out in 88, obviously, and Tim Burton directed it. This is a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah, so. This was an early Tim Burton.
Yeah, I love Tim Burton. I mean, I think this was maybe his second or third film right after Pee-wee's Big Adventure, so...
I don't know if you're going to be able to go all five with this being the case, but this is the third film you just mentioned I have not seen.
Whoa.
I'm not even kidding you. I've never seen Beetlejuice.
the other films I mentioned, they were great, and you can watch them, and I think you should. Beetlejuice, you should go out tonight and watch Beetlejuice.
It's a must, huh?
Yeah, I think every moment of your life having lived without seeing Beetlejuice has been a total waste. You need to go out and watch Beetlejuice.
Whoa, come on.
Dude, seriously, Beetlejuice, man.
I do want to see it. Don't get me wrong. And I mean, it's again, obviously, it's it came out in 88. I've seen parts numerous times, but I've never rented it, never got it from the library and put it in my DVD player and sat down and watched it. No, not a once.
The scene with this Calypso music and Beetlejuice is paid by this couple who are dead, but they don't know how to haunt. Their house is taken over by a yuppie couple from the city, and they sort of live this nice, pure farm life existence out in a rural town. And so they want these people out of their house, but they don't know how to be scary ghosts, so they hire Beetlejuice to do it for them, which is a big mistake, and that's sort of the plot of the movie. But he haunts this dinner, and they do, 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot punch, and they get possessed, and they start doing the dance, and it's freaking awesome. It's hilarious.
Nice.
There's so many classic great parts. Winona Ryder, Catherine O'Hara. You know who's in this, dude? The principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, Ed Rooney's in there?
Ed Rooney. Rooney! Jeffrey Jones
nine
is his name. Yeah.
Times.
That's right. Nine times.
So yeah. Don't get me wrong. I definitely, I got to put it on the queue, and I got to put it high on the queue.
Yeah.
Beetlejuice.
Actually, you should put it at number one.
Wow. Awesome. Strong pick at number three. Swings this over to me. This one comes on. It's a sentimental favorite of mine because it's a subject so near and dear to my heart. At number three, I have the film Eight Men Out.
Yeah. The White Sox.
Yes. John Cusack, Charlie Sheen, John Mahoney, Christopher Lloyd, David Stratham. Tells the story of the Black Sox scandals. This was fantastic. I'm a big White Sox fan. It was a film that took that matter and did it in a serious way. And I love old-time baseball stories like that. Throw you back to the past.
Sure.
When it seemed like everything was innocent and this was a scandal that sort of rocked them. And I love the whole shoeish Joe Jackson sort of legend that he was becoming. And the idea that he actually couldn't even read or write. So did he actually say that he was going to blow the World Series when everything proves that he really didn't. You know, he had a home run. He hit like 350 in the series, and still they banned him from baseball. And there's such interesting stories and such a really look back at the whole thing. The whole circumstance is very compelling.
That scandal is what led to the baseball commission, right?
Like, right. That's the first time that they have a baseball commissioner, and he makes the ruling. They actually found him in a court of law as being not guilty, and they all start celebrating at the end of the movie.
But they still couldn't play.
Right, and you see them all celebrating, and they crack open the champagne, and they're going to party that night, and now this new commissioner of baseball decides that, like, I mean, if we're going to clean up the sport, we should ban these guys from baseball. We can't take the chance of ruining the sport this way.
Set an example.
And they never played again.
Haven't they since, though, reinstated the record of of Joe, at least, I think?
No, they have not. And Buck Weaver is another – he's played in this movie by John Cusack. He went on and on. Tried to get his own trial because he was another one that totally said he didn't have anything to do with the scandal, didn't accept any money from anybody, but he was also banned from baseball. And I've signed petitions outside of Sox Park on opening day. There'll still be people out there to try to get Jack Weaver into the Hall of Fame and get him off the Black Sox scandal list. And it just won't happen.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. Yeah. I think after this long, they just sort of let it go.
Yeah, and I love the last scene. I've seen it so many times. I've only seen the movie a few times, but a lot of times it's one of those, when it's on, I'll watch the ending. And the very end, I love the idea of this Buck Weaver character goes out to some offshoot league, you know, semi-pro ball, and they're out there watching.
Yeah, like minor leagues.
Yeah, and Joe Jackson supposedly went on to play in other leagues since he couldn't play in major leagues, and he's out there in center field, and they're like, oh, he's playing too short, and the guy hits the ball, goes over his head, but of course he's so fast, he goes back there, catches it, and then everybody's like, man, is that him? Is that Joe Jackson? Obviously, being before television, no one exactly knew, you know,
what he looked like.
Yeah, your baseball cards and whatnot. And he's just like, nah, those guys are all gone, man, the Black Sox. And it's just so interesting, you know, and such a sad story because these guys were so great, some of them, like Shoeish Joe Jackson, and his time got cut short.
Is that the movie where they say, say it ain't so?
Yep.
Yeah. I love that movie. I've seen it a couple times.
Yeah.
It really
so
is.
That was my number three, Eight Men Out, a Chicago film.
Yeah. Americana right there.
Yeah. Swings us into our number twos, Matt.
All right. So this film, I really struggled with putting it on my list. Not because I don't think it's deserving. It so is. But I've mentioned it quite a few times on Jaw. Like, even going back to some of our first episodes. Love this movie. It's one of my favorites. It tops a many list for me. Akira. 1988, Akira.
I'm stunned. I missed this in my research. I didn't notice that it was a 1988 film.
Yeah, dude, it's true. I love it. Tetsuo, Kaneda, Tetsuo, we can do this thing again
sure.
and again. It's about a secret military project that endangers Neo-Tokyo when it turns a biker gang member into a rampaging psionic psychopath that not only two kids and a group of psionics can stop, but tries to destroy the city, yada, yada, yada. I mean, this is an adaptation from a sprawling Japanese comic book of the same name, and it's an epic, epic story. And because I have mentioned this so many times on The Jaw, I thought I would actually give you some trivia.
Oh, wow.
Some new facts about Akira that I haven't...
Akira trivia?
Akira trivia. I haven't mentioned this. This is the first Japanese anime film that the voices were recorded before it was animated.
Interesting.
Yeah, they always usually do it after. The film was re-released in 2001 with a new voice dub and soundtrack, reportedly costing over $1 million. At one point, Sony contemplated doing a live-action version of the film, but it would have cost $300 million, so they scrapped it. This one's interesting. This movie consists of 2,200 shots and 160,000 single pictures, 2 to 3 times more than usual, using 327 different colors, another record in animation. Not Japanese animation.
Sure.
50 colors were exclusively created for this film. The reason for this statistic is that most of the movie takes place at night, a setting that is traditionally avoided by animators because of the increased color requirements.
Interesting.
Isn't that crazy, man?
Yeah.
So
I mean, obviously, I'm a big fan of this film as well. And I urge anybody who has not seen it to definitely check this one out. It's just one you got to see to really appreciate everything that goes on. Like you say, it's epic, and not only the storytelling, but also the animation, everything about it. It's just like, wow, what a strong, strong film.
Yeah, it really is. If you take one thing away from Cinema Jaw that you learned from Matt Kay, I would say watch Akira. That's what I want it to be.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah. And Beetlejuice for you.
Yeah. All right, swings us over to my number two. This is a real big one. How big? It's big at number two. Tom Hanks in Big. I love this one.
Yeah.
Tom Hanks, Elizabeth Perkins. This one's so fantastic. I mean, this was really, I had it here that it was, quote unquote, a big film for Hanks, who showed for the first time hints of a dramatic side because, yeah, it's funny and whatnot. But it's also like, I think when you look at the Hanks filmography, it's that in-betweener film that was still funny, but it wasn't like Bachelor Party funny.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and all his other screwball stuff. It was comedy, but it also had some drama to it. And I think a lot of people took note of that and realized, wow, I think Tom Hanks could really cross over and do something a lot bigger than just screwball comedies.
Yeah, there was a definite depth to that. It was a turning point for Tom Hanks.
It was, and I mean, it was such an interesting story. I think we've seen it numerous times in slightly different ways.
Yeah.
The idea that the kid gets transformed into a big body or vice versa. It happens now, it seems, all the time.
Yeah, vice versa was another example with Judge Reinhold and yeah. Kevin Arnold. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
So. And so in this case, though, it works. Sometimes you can watch it. It's an interesting idea, but it's sort of novel. And
it could have flopped. It could have really flopped.
In the hands of Tom Hanks, it just worked perfectly because you needed to believe the whole time that it was a kid inside the grown-up's body. And I think that's where all the rest of them fail so many times is they don't take that as such a serious note that I think Hanks did. It's like, hey, I'm supposed to be an 8-year-old in this grown-up's body.
I think he was 13.
Or 13, whatever he is, yeah. And it's just amazing to see that happen. I mean, there's parts where my favorite part, obviously, is when they're showing the toy at the big meeting because he works for the toy factory, and they show him this robot that turns into a building, and they're going around, and all of them are talking about how they're going to market it, and Tom Hanks gets it. He's been playing with it forever. And then they look over, they're like, Josh, it looks like you got something to say. He's like, I don't get it. You know, just like a kid would, you know. He's just like, well, what don't you get? He's like, I don't know. I just don't get it. He's like, it's no fun, you know. And it's just hilarious. And I think he totally nailed it. I love Big. Classic Tom Hanks film.
Excellent pick, dude. The only reason I didn't put it higher on my list is because I was pretty damn sure you were going to put it up there. So.
Wonderful. Yeah. And I did.
Yeah, it deserves that spot for sure.
And before Matt gets to his number one, the other category of the Academy Awards that I wanted to note was actresses up for a leading role that year were Glenn Close in Dangerous Liaisons, Jodie Foster, The Accused, Melanie Griffith, Working Girl, Meryl Streep, A Cry in the Dark, and Sigourney Weaver, Gorillas in the Mist.
Really? Meryl Streep nominated for an Oscar? You don't see that too often.
Shocking.
Yeah. You know, and Jodie Foster won.
Yes, she won for The Accused. And I should mention that Dustin Hoffman won for Rain Man.
Yeah.
And Rain Man won for Best Movie.
Yeah, as long as we're doing the list, Best Supporting Actor, Kevin Kline in A Fish Called Wanda, which I mentioned if you were listening rapid fire before. And supporting actress was Gina Davis. Not for Beetlejuice, though. It was The Accidental Tourist. So.
Mm. So it brings us to Matt's number one.
Oh, yeah, my number one. Okay, again, one that I've talked about so many times, and I'll just start this conversation off by saying, the royal penis is clean, Your Highness. Coming to America. Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall. Arsenio! And probably his best acting role ever.
Yeah.
I mean, really, what else is there for Arsenio?
I agree. I'm a little shocked that it's your number one, but you are a huge fan of it, I guess.
I love this movie. I've seen it 800 times, man. Coming to America is, it's almost as quotable as Spaceballs.
Wow.
Almost as quotable.
Yeah.
You know? I love it.
I mean, this was the Eddie Murphy tour de force.
If you watch the movie really closely, you'll see a young Samuel L. Jackson as the robber that holds up the McDougal's or whatever the restaurant is called, who gets thwarted by Eddie Murphy and Arsenio.
Samuel L.'s in there, huh?
Yeah, Sam Jackson, he's there.
That's awesome.
It's freaking amazing. I love this movie.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I just wonder if it's going to hold up the next time I view it.
It will. I've seen it recently. The jokes, maybe they're a little played, but only because, like, you know, you'll have this with any comedy movie. You see it 500 times, and it's just starts to get a little old. But, like, Trading Places, I'd put it on the Pantheon of Eddie Murphy. Probably his best work.
Yeah.
1988.
I probably wouldn't argue with you there as far as being Eddie Murphy's best work, but I don't know if it was the best movie of 1988. In my case, my number one, I actually agree with the Academy Awards on this one, and I am picking Rain Man as my favorite movie of 1988. You a fan of this one?
Yeah. Babbitt!
You got Tom Cruise and Dustin Hoffman playing Ray and Charlie Babbitt. Hoffman soars, there's no doubt about it. But I love Tom Cruise. He's the perfect quintessential Tom Cruise role in this movie. It's what we've come to love about Tom Cruise and now almost make fun of for being Tom Cruise. But at that time, he just knocked it out of the park.
The D-bag with a heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's who he is. This is prototypical Jerry Maguire, you know?
He has got so many funny lines. I watched this, I don't know, maybe a year ago at most. I bought it and put it in the DVD collection. Rewatched it and thought, what a joy. I had so much fun watching it. Tom Cruise, like I said, hilarious. Dustin Hoffman, you got all those great lines with Wapner, Wapner.
Yeah, Wapner.
Time to watch Wapner.
Of course, got to go to Kmart to buy my underwear.
And you got that classic scene where they go get their suits on. They look sharp as a penny, and they're going to go down to the casino.
Counting cards.
And they come down the escalator. The light hits them just perfectly. Just so fantastic. I mean, the whole story of going there to count the cards.
Yeah, I think they did that shot in The Hangover, didn't they? With Zach Galifianakis coming down the elevator.
Yes.
Yeah, it was funny.
Yeah, it's been parodied many a times.
It has.
Yeah, I love Rain Man. Definitely check it out, you jawheads, if you haven't seen it out there. Before we go to break, I did want to mention other notables. We may have mentioned some in Matt's rapid fire, but some that I had down, obviously A Fish Called Wanda, Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Working Girl, Beaches, Above the Law.
Oh, for sure. I'm surprised to hear you mention that as a notable.
Yes.
Steven Seagal.
Another Woman, which was a Woody Allen, wanted to mention. Bloodsport.
Oh, fantastic.
Thought that was going to be on your list.
Van Damminator's best film right there.
Die Hard, you mentioned. Colors.
Colors, yeah.
Sean Penn and Robert Duvall.
That's a great film.
Cocktail, Frantic with Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford. Right.
Sure. The Great Outdoors.
Oh, yeah, totally. I did. I think I mentioned Great Outdoors.
Yeah. License to Drive.
Yep.
Midnight Run. Punchline with Tom Hanks.
Sally Field.
Reno's favorite movie of all time, Tucker, The Man Who Had a Dream.
I was totally going to mention that.
Also a 1988 film. And Young Guns, which you mentioned also.
Yep.
And it's a cheesy Western, but I'm a fan. I think you are, too.
I am. I think the second one was better, but this is where it began. So
yeah, no doubt about it. So that was our look back at 1988.
Great year for film, man.
Oh, it was. Fun year to always look back. And it's so shocking that what films came out in that particular
year. Honestly, like 1988, I think I saw almost every film that came out, dude.
Oh, man, that is awesome. That is awesome. So what we're going to do is take a break. We're going to come back. We got Hollywood headlines, some DVD reviews for you, and if we have time, maybe even some trivia.
Sounds good. We'll be right
back on Cinema Jaw.
Hi, I'm Matt Kay with a Cinema Jaw movie fact. Concerning the film Rain Man, director Barry Levinson admitted that Ray's comment about Qantas being the only aircraft company to never have had a fatal crash was made up, and that he didn't know if it was true. In reality, Qantas has had 8 crashes all prior to the filming of this movie. However, they were all propeller-driven planes, not jets. And that is your Cinema Jaw movie fact.
And we're back on Cinema Jaw, Matt. Let's do some Hollywood headlines.
Let's do it, man. We haven't done it in a while.
How about this, Matt? The Brothers Grimm, Snow White, has found its evil queen. Entertainment Weekly has confirmed, as rumored, Julia Roberts will be playing the villainous role.
You know what? That makes total sense with her horse teeth. I can see her. She doesn't even have to put on any makeup.
I love it. You know what? I actually think, as funny as that is, I actually think that it's a good role for her. Change it up and do something different than the stupid romantic comedies that she usually goes for.
She's getting too old for him, dude.
I agree. So this will be interesting.
All right, I got one for you. Oscar-winning filmmaker Michael Moore has filed a lawsuit in Los Angeles against the power producers Bob and Harvey Weinstein for allegedly cheating him out of $2.7 million from the hit 2004 documentary Fahrenheit 9/11.
You know what? I'm going to make my own documentary about this fact that they're swindling money from them. Let's go inside the Weinsteins and see where this money exactly went. Let's trace it.
Yeah, he's probably already making the documentary. What would you call it?
Let's call it The Hunt for Michael Moore's Money.
Yeah. Weinstein 9/11?
There you go.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Bowling for Moore.
Yeah, I like it. Bowling for Moore.
Bowling for Moore.
Yeah.
We got a winner. All right, how about this one, Matt? One of the quickest films to reach a wide audience following its Sundance premiere last month, Eugene Jarrick's Reagan debuts on HBO, fittingly a day after Ronald Reagan's 100th birthday. As I've reported here on Cinema Jaw, I wanted a Reagan biopic, and now we got one.
They're listening to us, Rye. You heard it here first.
Unbelievable.
Yep.
I tell you, tear down this wall, Mr. Gorbachev.
That's right. What a hero that man was. And you know what? He was also the president in 1988.
Well, it was changing over to him, but you're right.
Yeah.
He switched it over to Bush.
Yep.
Old man Bush.
All right. Gossip website TMZ is reporting that Lindsay Lohan is up for a major role in Zack Snyder's Superman reboot. According to the site, quote, Lindsay's people have had multiple phone conversations within the last few weeks with the people behind the new Superman reboot, end quote.
Whoa, Sticky Fingers Lohan. You know, now she's reportedly being accused of stealing some necklace from a jewelry shop. I want her nowhere near the Superman reboot. Not that I'm all that excited about the Superman reboot, but I definitely don't want to see Lindsay Lohan. How about you?
I think that somebody should tell Lindsay Lohan's people that her calling up Zack Snyder in the middle of the night to say, "Let me in your movie," does not constitute her people talking with his people.
One more time on that Lindsay Lohan impersonation.
"Let me in your movie." That's pretty accurate.
I agree. And you know what? I hope we don't see her, you know?
If she was in it, though, let's just scenario here. No way is she going for Lois Lane,
oh,
right?
Oh, no way. She would play some character that would get killed early on. She'd be more like 10 minutes into the movie. Everybody would think she has a major role in it, and then a boulder would smash her head.
Yeah, I hope so. Let's hope that happens. Superman doesn't quite get there in time.
Oh, boy. All right. On to some DVD reviews, Matt.
Poor Lindsay.
I caught Buried.
Speaking of...
All right. All right. Buried, recently named Sexiest Man Alive, Ryan Reynolds, is trapped in a coffin for the entire movie. How can this be good? Well, the story is interesting, for one. The movie opens up with Reynolds' character waking up to find himself buried in the ground in a wooden coffin. He works for a construction company driving a truck in Iraq when his team is ambushed. We then find out that the people who ambushed him left his cell phone in the coffin so that he can have minimal conversation with U.S. authority with hopes of getting some ransom money. The story does keep you guessing all the way to the end. The other great thing is seeing how this is shot. Camera moving in the coffin for tracking shots. The lighting, Matt, is done very well, considering there's only a lighter, a cell phone, and a flashlight in the coffin. Bravo on the production of the film.
What kind of cell phone does he have?
It's a BlackBerry. Okay. Let's just say, though, this, Matt. The movie is just good enough to let you forget you're watching a movie with Ryan Reynolds in it. Ryan, the movie guy's great. 2.5 Jaws on this one. A B-. It's not bad by no means. It's not great.
Didn't he know the three-fingered punch from Kill Bill to get at it?
Oh, we kept doing it. Me and Jen were watching it the whole time. We kept doing the old punch. Come on, let's get out of the coffin already.
Did he try it at least?
He doesn't even really give a good effort. That's what I thought too. And at the end, there's dirt falling in. I thought, well, this is when I'd make my move. I mean, I'm not going to just lay in the coffin. I'd start punching and going crazy.
Have you ever seen that episode of Mythbusters? It's actually completely impossible to get out from a coffin if you're under 6 feet
of dirt.
And I
would imagine.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You're dead.
But the other thing, too, is they were saying, in the film, they present the idea that if the cell phone signal was working and working as good as it was, he probably wasn't 6 feet under. Maybe it was a foot under, you know. And really, it's interesting. It's got a lot of twists and turns. And literally, there's no other actors in the movie. It's just him in the coffin the entire time. The camera
no flashbacks?
Never,
nothing?
No, nothing ever comes back out of the thing. So you are with him the entire
text
time.
Text messages? Something? I mean,
he's texting, but you're not seeing who, you know, you got conversation of
sounds
people
freaking
on,
boring.
On the phone that he's with. But it's interesting,
so,
you know.
No other actors and no 3-inch punches. I don't know.
Yeah. But you got Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah. You liked it, though.
I did. 2.5 Jaws on that one.
Right,
the other one
I
caught, Matt, was Secretariat. Disney, who has mastered telling the story of an underdog, gives us a movie about the most famous horse of all time. Diane Lane stars as the horse's owner, and she is upstaged by the performance of the horse. The horse must have watched old footage of the real Secretariat because he had it all down, from the trot to the tail swing to the way he ate grass. This performance was spot on. This is a heartwarming film that made me want to get out to the track and blow all my money on the 5 horse in the 3rd race, who's supposed to be a closer, but the only thing he's good at closing is my savings account. Let it ride, Matt. I love a horse racing movie. I'm giving this one 3 Jaws or a grade of a B for Secretariat.
That was a fantastic review, man. I liked that a lot.
Thank you. We watched this one with Jen's whole family. Jen's mom is a huge horse fan, and she always pushes seeing these horse movies, and she had brought it over to our house after a Sunday brunch, and it fit perfect. It's one of those kinds of movies that you'd love to watch with the whole kind of family. Who doesn't know the story of Secretariat?
Yeah.
She won the Triple Crown, this horse, and you watch it, and it's just a joy to watch. So
whenever you don't know the answer in Trivial Pursuit, the answer is probably the Secretariat, or if it's a horse question.
Yeah, no doubt about it. If it's a horse racing, Just say Secretariat. Yeah. Yeah.
So my question is now, of the two major horse racing movies in the last 10 years, which is superior? Seabiscuit or Secretariat?
Boy, you're spot on, Matt. I asked the same question right when the movie ended, everybody in the room, and we were split. I think Seabiscuit more because I didn't know the story of Seabiscuit, and that's why. But the characters actually are sort of the same. They go with the trainer. In Seabiscuit, you have Chris Cooper, who trains the horse. Secretariat, you have...
John Malkovich.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Yes, John Malkovich is the trainer in this one. And then you have the owner. You know, it's very similar of the same people that are involved cheering on the horse. But I, for me, for my money, I'd go Seabiscuit.
Okay. All right. I haven't seen either of them, so.
Yeah. Well, give this one a spin, Secretary.
My horse movie marathon is coming up, so they're both on the queue.
Wonderful. Watch them before the Derby.
Good call.
Now, you caught a couple interesting films.
I did. I'm in this huge documentary kick.
Which I like.
Yeah. I'm loving it. So I saw Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. And what a piece of work it is.
Oh, I want to see this one.
You know, I think you should. It's really interesting to see, like, how relentlessly pursuant of her career, if that's a word, she is to this day. And I think she's pushing 80, if she's not already 80.
Late 70s.
She's opening up for Don Rickles out in some, like, backwater town in Wisconsin, and she globetrots all over the place. I mean, she's pretty wealthy, but it's not from sitting on her ass. It's from working hard in showbiz, and you come to have this respect for Joan Rivers, as appallingly unattractive she is. You know, you kind of gain this respect for her, and you just see how hard she's really worked in showbiz, and... You know, from her appearances on Johnny Carson in the 60s to up till today. As a documentary, though, I would say that I would like to have seen a little bit more of that exploration of her character and her history. They show a few clips, but it's mostly about her and Celebrity Apprentice and her work today. Mm-hmm. And you could tell that Joan Rivers was a producer on this.
Sure.
There is almost no bad... she's never cast in a bad light whatsoever. So it doesn't go too deep. Is it interesting? Yeah, it's pretty cool. Joan Rivers is a very interesting person, so I like the movie. I'd give it 2.5 Jaws. And then I also caught The Corporation. Have you heard of this one?
I've actually seen it. It's been a little while since I've seen it, but I have seen The Corporation.
So the basic premise of this movie is they say, well, a corporation is a legal person. According to the law, it's a person. So what kind of a person is this legal entity? And it turns out they do a checklist, and it's a psychopath. I mean, it has no remorse, no regard for others, safety, or anything like that. And so basically we're letting psychopaths, like, effectively rule the world.
Right. Because the corporations are ruling the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty interesting stuff, really deep, really informative. I got to be honest, though. First time I put it on, I fell asleep. So the next day, I watched more of it, fell asleep. And then the third day, I was like, okay, I got to watch this. It's good, but I think they could have shortened it up, been a little snappier between the takes, and made this a bit tighter. It was a little long-winded, but overall, I liked it. Again, 2.5 Jaws.
Nice. I'd agree with that. 2.5-3 Jaws for me for The Corporation. It's been a little while since I've seen it, but yeah, I'd recommend.
Spin it, especially if you're interested in this sort of thing and you like documentaries.
Yeah, definitely. Good reviews there.
Thanks.
So there was our DVD reviews. Got a little time here, so we're going to play some trivia. Matt's venturing out to the front bar. Looks like Matt has found a contestant here to take on in Denzel Washington movie trivia we're having
tonight.
Wow,
that's a subject.
Matt, who'd you pull from the bar?
This is Sean. He's been at Mother's for a long time. He's a great dude.
Hi, guys. How are you doing today?
Good, man. Thanks
Welcome
for coming.
Welcome to Cinema Jaw.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're about to get your ass kicked, dude.
I imagine. Denzel Washington, you probably should have grabbed someone else.
Well, we're doing this trivia in honor of Denzel Washington's movie about the unstoppable train called Unstoppable.
Oh, well, that's a great title.
And so we are doing Denzel Washington trivia. Sean, you're our guest. You get to choose if you want to go first or let Matt go first. There are steals. If the person doesn't know it, you get to answer his question.
You know what? I'll take a crack at it first.
All right. Question number one over to Sean. In Man on Fire, Denzel's character is hired to protect a family whose young daughter is played by...
Dakota Fanning.
1-0, Sean. We got a ringer, Matt.
Nah.
Question number two. In 2009, Washington was in another train movie of sorts opposite John Travolta. This time, it took place inside a New York subway.
Oh, the taking of Phelim 134? Oh, crap.
It was close enough. Taking of Pelham 123.
Okay.
All right. 1-1. Sean, question over to you. Denzel won Best Actor for this cop drama in 2001.
Ooh, that would be Training Day.
Great movie.
2-1, Sean. 2-1, Sean. We throw it over to Matt. Denzel was in Courage Under Fire opposite this leading lady. Courage Under Fire. Denzel Washington and who?
Oh, it was, what's her name? Oh, man. The Australian chick.
Denzel Washington, Courage Under Fire. His leading lady in this one was?
I'm drawing a blank. Kim Basinger.
We throw it over to Sean for the steal.
It's an Australian chick, huh? Yeah. I'll go with,
I don't know if that's right. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. I'll just say her name. Claire Danes. I don't know why I said that.
It was Meg Ryan. Oh, Meg Ryan, not Australian.
She could be.
Stays 2-1, Sean. This question's over to Sean. He could blow it wide open here. Denzel played a boxer who spent a long time behind bars in this 1999 drama.
The Hurricane.
Ooh, Commander.
3-1, Sean. He is looking commanding.
3-1? No, I got two.
3-1. Oh, 3-1. Throw it over to Matt. Denzel was excellent in Glory. Who played the colonel of his company?
Oh, Matthew Broderick.
3-2. This is the last question of the game. Sean can wrap it up here with a correct answer. In 2007, Denzel starred opposite Russell Crowe in this crime drama. Denzel Washington, Russell Crowe.
I think that's American Gangster, right?
Oh,
we got
man.
A winner. We got a winner. 4-2. Sean wins. We did have a jawbreaker closest to, if it was close to a tie, but Sean beat Matt. He won the Oscar for Training Day, but what was his payday for it, Matt? Closest to. How much did Denzel get paid for Training Day?
That was a high-budget film. I would say at least 15. 15
Sean,
million.
You got a guess?
Well, I'd say 10, maybe. 10 million.
We'd give it to Sean, $12 million. He's winning everything today.
Oh, that's right in between, man.
No, it's a little bit closer to 10 if my math's correct.
Oh, well.
But anyway, right. Sean's the winner. That puts Matt at 2-3 on the year. You were 500 coming in. Now you're sub-500.
Damn you, Sean. Damn you.
Thank you, thank you.
All right. Want to thank Sean for coming on.
Are we wrapping it up?
We are. Another great cinema jaw right here.
Indeed. 1988. Great year.
It was. And this was a great jaw.
Yep. So follow us on Facebook.
Check us out on Twitter.
And email us at mattandrye@cinemajaw.com.
Thanks to PBR, our sponsor. Thanks to Stranger Days Radio.
Thanks to Steve Reno Mrazek, best producer in the business.
And thanks to our new theme song.
Yeah, thanks for that, Piss Weasel.
All right, till next week, keep on jawing about the movies.